Hi, everybody. It is now 3 o'clock and we will be starting our session. Hello, Zapigo. This is season 3, episode 2. In total, we are at episode 14. And I would like to thank all of you for all the support that you've given us across 3 seasons. Just to note that there will be one session, one Hello Zapigo session every month until November. Marina is taking a short break, but she will be back from time to time to host a Hello Zapigo episode every now and then. I would just like to remind everybody to stay till the end of the session because we will be taking a group picture just to show that everybody, you know, just to show our appreciation for everybody who came and participated in this session. So before we begin, I would like to give a shout out to Ori, who has sponsored the tops that myself and Lavender have on. I guess they are available in a variety of colors. And if you are interested in making a purchase, this top in particular is the Marina 3/4 sleeve dolman top, which is inspired by Zapigo founder Marina Mahathir. The link will be shared in the chat here on Zoom. And I think it will also be added to the Facebook cast. So you'll be able to purchase the top. Now, going to our guests, I would like to welcome both Lavender Tan and Sarima Ibrahim. Lavender is a clinical psychologist with The Mind, which is a psychology center that provides therapy and counseling services for individuals, couples, families, as well as corporate wellness. She's been a clinical psychologist for a little over 3 years now. Our second guest is Chipwan Sarima Ibrahim, who is, I don't think she's a stranger to any of us. I mean, if you're Malaysian, you've probably seen her all over TV, you've heard her on radio, and just newspapers, magazines. So she's a TV host, actress, professional MC, and a recording artist for the last 25 years now. Is that it? Yeah.
Quite long. She's also getting old.
Moderator in discussions and forums both online and offline, focusing especially on topics related to mental health, women's welfare, and cybersecurity. Sarima was the ambassador for Women's Center for Change in Penang, a cervical cancer awareness ambassador with MAKNA, and an active speaker with MIASA Malaysia. She has recently been appointed patron of MIASA, which is the Mental Illness Awareness and Support Association. And she is also the mother of almost 2-year-old Tunku Sophia Najiha and wife to Yang Mulia Tunku Nazimuddin Tunku Muzaffar. Before we go on to this session where we will be speaking about taking ownership of your health and well-being, I'd like to read out some recent statistics from the World Health Organization. Every year, 1 million people die of suicide, which is one death every 40 seconds. And it is predicted that by the year 2020, which was basically last year, the suicide rate will increase to one death every 20 seconds. Suicide is one of the 3 leading causes of death after heart disease and cancer. Depression and substance abuse contributes to more than 90% of all suicide cases. And in 2011, 1 in 10 people is said to have mental illness. But in 2016, it has increased to 1 in 5. And in Malaysia, the number of psychiatrists to patients is 1 to every 200,000 people. Now, it's never too early or late to take care of yourself and make healthy changes to your routine. So when you think, so just so that you think, feel, and look the best for yourself. Now, this Women's Health Month, it's very important in Team Zapigo that we encourage women to take control starting from within. Now, I would like to just, you know, move immediately right into our questions with Lavender and Sarima. Now, let's start with the basics. Lavender, what are the different types of therapy available here in Malaysia?
So I think like what you're asking about are therapeutic modalities, right?
So a lot of people have heard of some of the mainstream ones, cognitive behavioral therapy, which focuses on your belief system and your perspective and how that affects your behaviors. But there are a lot of new waves ones like acceptance and commitment therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy. These are all evidence-based therapies. There might be some others that are alternative methods, but I think what we want to focus on understanding is that it's not necessarily about the modalities. It's about the clinician. So I think a lot of my clients, a lot of friends ask me like, oh, how do I know what's right for me? Should I go for hypnosis? Should I go for CBT? What you want to look for is a qualified clinician. So a psychiatrist, somebody who has been to medical school, mm-hmm. a clinical psychologist or a counselor, both with a practice-based master's or PhD, meaning they actually have practicum experience. They have experience working with people in trainings. So the key thing is that it's not somebody who maybe took one course in CBT and calls themselves a therapist, right? So that's what you want to be very careful about, because like this is what my director Joel says, just because you can change a car tire does not make you a mechanic.
Yeah.
So depending on, you know, the experience and the qualifications of the therapist, they should be able to look at your big picture experiences and identify the kind of techniques that will be useful for you. So all of these little modalities, they're just techniques rather than just the main and only way to treat a certain issue.
Okay. Sorry, Ma. So you've studied psychology and you've also been a mental therapy peer, and you've attended several different types of therapies like available here in Malaysia. So you've done CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, regression therapy, hypnotherapy, and also something called EMDR. Tell us why mental therapy was something you needed in your life. I mean, considering I think this is pretty much well known, like you went through a divorce about, I would say, a decade ago, I think. And it's been mentioned in a few media outlets that you also experienced postnatal depression. So what made you, start with therapy, and how did therapy help you with these particular events in your life?
Right. Well, thanks, Eliza. And hi to everyone. Thanks for having me today to share my two cents. And as a peer and also a caregiver, actually, I do have some family and friends who've been through a lot of mental health challenges, I would call them. Because, that's the thing that I wanted to touch on. Obviously, I'm not a professional like Lavender is, but to be honest, the amount of studying I've done, Lavender, I probably should have my master's or my postgraduate up my sleeve now, but it's okay. Module per module is how I'm going at it here. I'm actually living it module per module. I started getting therapy. See, it's funny when you say the word therapy, because people assume you've got to have something wrong with you to have to go for therapy, right? But it was quite the contrary for me. I felt like there was absolutely nothing wrong with me. About 10 years ago, actually prior, just before my divorce, when I was 28, 29, I decided that I wanted to obviously continue my studies in psychology, because I had started off wanting to be what Lavender is. And then I, by accident, got on the path of entertainment, and for 22 years was an entertainer, but studying part-time in the background. And I had that passion, and I still have that passion for understanding human behavior, and more than that, human emotions and thoughts. And because of that, I wanted to learn more. And in order to learn, I believe you have to sit in the actual chair. So I decided to sign up for several types of therapy. I started off with CBT, which is cognitive behavioral, as it explained just now. And that's more like, correct me if I'm wrong, Lavender, but I'll only speak today based on my experience. It was more about thoughts, and it was more about questions and thinking and insights and using your cognitive, basically your mind, to decipher and understand and improve and, come up with different ideas and to help you change your behavior ultimately. And then I decided after, a few months of doing that, that I wanted to try other forms of therapy like hypnotherapy, et cetera, to help with feelings, anxiety and stuff. So the more I did therapy, the more I realized what was wrong with me. Not wrong, but you start going like, you mean it's not normal to be having like panic attacks before you go on stage in front of 3 million people? And then you start realizing, hang on a second. So I decided to do it for educational purposes and therapeutic purposes for me, and to understand friends and family. That's why I say I was a caregiver. Friends and family members who are going through mental health challenges, because if you love people, you want to be able to help them. And I don't see therapy as something that you do as a last sort of attempt. You don't go to therapy, you don't go to doctors only when you're bleeding to death, or hopefully you don't, or when you're already on your deathbed. You obviously try and go before things get pretty bad, and so before it becomes a psychological disease, I believe, or disorder, I wanted to catch myself and maintain my mental and emotional health. So it's been about 10, 11 years of various types of therapy. And the last 5 years, I've been focused on trauma therapy, with my therapist being one of the only qualified EMDR directors in the country. So I've been doing that with her, and that is more into the psychotherapy aspect of things, which I'm sure Lavender will be able to explain. So it goes more into the past and how that shapes your behavior and unlocking trauma within the body that you're not aware of, which can influence how you perceive the present. So I wanted to do that to just keep myself on track, because I've seen people, I know people who've taken their own lives. I know family and friends who have suffered. And I have had panic attacks and anxiety for many, many years. And I just thought it was just being me. And a lot of people wouldn't expect that from someone like me, right? Because I'm like this happy-go-lucky, you know, always smiling person. But there is a term, I believe, Lavender, smiling depression, a sort of, you know, mask, even though we all wear masks. So I continue to do that till today. I go for therapy every week, even when I feel everything's fine. And yeah, you're right, Eliza. I had postnatal depression after I gave birth, which shocked me, because for someone who has been in therapy to still get postnatal depression, that was a pretty scary thing.
Okay. Lavender, can you explain, because Sarima mentioned EMDR therapy. Can you explain what that is?
Okay, EMDR, it's a form of therapy that addresses your trauma that uses eye movement desensitization. So there's a lot of theories behind it, and the professionals who do it actually have to be trained in it and qualified in it. I think in Malaysia, it's not massive yet. There are only a number of professionals who are trained in it. And it's helpful for some, it's not helpful for everyone, the same way most therapy modalities are.
Right. Okay. Now, Lavender, what seems to be the pattern with mental health struggles in Malaysians?
That's a good question. And Sarima, thank you so much for sharing your experience. One thing that you mentioned was that, you know, you don't want to only go for therapy when it's at the very last minute when you're bleeding to death. Unfortunately, that is one thing, one of the patterns that I do observe in a lot of the clients who come in. Typically, a lot of their issues have been ongoing for quite some time. So maybe right now they're experiencing symptoms of anxiety or depression. They can't get out of bed. They're not motivated to go to work. They just find no meaning and they don't understand where it's coming from. And of course, depression doesn't just affect your mood, right? It also affects your ability to make decisions. It affects your ability to, learn or concentrate. They're saying things like, oh, I just don't understand. I'm sitting in a meeting. Nothing is going in. Right. And actually, when you speak to them, these things have been around for a very long time. It's not like, okay, it's been there for the past month and they notice it. They come in when it's gotten so bad, they can't manage it. So that's one pattern that I notice, is kind of prolonged suffering. Another pattern that I do notice is unrecognized trauma. So I do have a lot of clients coming in, and typically their presenting problems are things like unexplainable panic attacks, right? Or I just can't concentrate at work, I'm not performing, I'm not doing well. But actually, when I sit down with them and we actually go through a lot of their history, what they've been through, a lot of things actually start to emerge. So for example, individuals who witnessed a parent dying of a heart attack, growing up in like highly emotional conflict within their family, a lot of fights, a lot of emotional abuse, Or even things like undiagnosed mental illnesses, that's an issue. It's a combination of the two patterns, right? So for example, an adult might come in and as we talk and we assess all of the symptoms, this person actually meets criteria for attention deficit hyperactive disorder. So, you know, they have executive function issues, inability to focus on exactly one thing, or maybe they have a lot of hyperactive symptoms. So the problem is that because it's so prolonged, they actually collect a lot of trauma along the way, because like having trouble concentrating in class or having trouble organizing things in a certain way, it actually triggers a lot of bullying, or maybe in school, parents and teachers will actually put them down for being naughty or lazy or things like that. So they collect a lot of all these kind of dramas and affects their self-esteem, the way they view themselves. So this is the general pattern that I do observe.
Okay. Personally, I feel like a lot of Malaysians, and I mean, this is, you know, purely just out of my observation. I feel like a lot of Malaysians tend to dismiss the need for therapy, and they seem to want to cope or find a solution or a distraction on their own. I'm not saying this is entirely a bad thing, you know, but it may not be a good thing either. So what are the pros and cons to this? I'd like for, you know, the both of you to kind of chime in on this.
Well, shall I go first?
Yeah.
I think that firstly, a lot of us use distractions to numb out from pain that we feel, and the distractions look unfortunately socially acceptable, such as constantly needing to work, constantly needing to achieve something. That can be considered a distraction too, and I understand that because that's where I have been before, and I'm still working on that. The need to fill the hole within with as many things as possible, be it traveling nonstop in the belief that if I go somewhere, that place will heal me, rather than going within and, you know, stopping the distraction and sort of just waiting. I mean, the pros, of course, of distractions, if you're asking that, Eliza, is, you know, you would gain more in life in terms of traveling, and you would achieve, and you would have all the medals and the awards, and you'd become the CEO, and you'd get the money, and you'd get the 6 children and whatnot. But the cons are there as well, and that's something that we don't really highlight in society, because, you know, we're all about go, go, go. You know, if you want to be somebody, if you want to be fulfilled, you've got to go somewhere to heal, achieve something. One day you'll get there, you know, and you're like, where's there? You know, that's the constant question. So I had to learn to undo a lot of beliefs about achieving and doing, and I had to stop moving and stop doing in order to heal. And a massive amount of EMDR therapy and CBT therapy, and just generally sitting with my therapist in silence and very uncomfortable, because I fill space with words to avoid feeling any of the repressed pain. And I think a lot of people do that. And if they're not filling it with words, filling it with thoughts. And if you're not filling it with thoughts and words, they're doing, they're moving. Unfortunately, in society, it looks like you're doing well. You're running another Ironman? Good job. You're half dead running it, but good job, man. But if you're substance abusing, what's wrong with you? So I always like to quote from Gabor Mate, a very well-known speaker, motivator, and doctor, who always says, you know, ask not why the addiction, but why the pain. You know, people go to something because they're trying to usually numb out or run or distract from something. It's just a matter of what you choose to be that something, and how long you can maintain that. So in our society, I think here in Malaysia, from all the talks and what I've realized as patron of Miasa, there's a lot of denial. And there's a lot of focus on achievement within our society. And if you've achieved a lot and you have a lot of money, you have nothing to complain about, because traumas don't exist in our society. You should be able to forget and forgive and move on. And that's when people distract with a lot of things and, you know, kicks in the workaholism and the substance abuse and alcoholism. And you see all the social things and numbing out that happens.
Right. Lavender?
Yeah, I do agree. A lot of distractions, right? And like what Sarima mentioned about traumas not existing, that is so true. And that's part of the reason why a lot of clients sitting in front of me, they're presenting a problem is not, you know, I was emotionally abused as a child. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, I witnessed my parent committing suicide. It's usually not like that. They come in and the things that they say is, I don't know why I can't focus at work. Right? Like my brain's not just not working. So it is true that it's a little bit of a con in the sense that, you know, we don't acknowledge the trauma. So when we actually get to the point in therapy of talking about these experiences that they've had, what they say is, oh, I didn't realize that was a trauma event because nobody talks about it. So my whole family just acts like it's normal, nothing's happening. So I think part of the reason people don't seek help is because to begin with, they can't acknowledge that they have been through trauma, right? So there's a lot of self-doubt when it comes to it. They will say, oh, why should I get therapy? I'm pretty privileged. I shouldn't be suffering, you know? They're actually beating themselves up for their pain. I should just walk it off. I should be strong enough. I haven't been through anything, you know? I'm fine. I'm clothed. I'm fed, you know? They don't acknowledge these traumas. So to them, like going to therapy or seeking help is being a baby because they've had such a good life and other people have it worse and I shouldn't be so self-indulgent. So they see therapy as something that is very self-indulgent. You know, so that's part of the reason. Although I guess for certain people, maybe they have good enough social support, maybe they have mental health issues, but they have people they can really talk to. Ultimately, we are a more collectivistic culture than maybe some of the Western cultures. So in some cases, that is the case. You have good support, you don't need therapy, or maybe you have enough access to a lot of resources where you can learn and you can self-develop. So I'm not saying it's always a bad thing and it's always a must. But as long as it's not a case of distracting or putting yourself down and telling yourself you don't deserve help and support.
Okay. What is a good amount of time, or is there no, like, you know, time frame to therapy? Like, you know how, like, if you're sick, you know, and you have a bacterial infection, you go to a doctor, they give you antibiotics and they, okay, you know, it's a 14-day course. Whatever, or you're supposed to do this for 21 days or 40 days or 6 months or whatever. With therapy, how long do you think it takes to kind of break through or possibly break down the problem for them to start healing?
We get a question, sorry?
Or even any results to begin with.
Okay, so that's really difficult to answer because it depends on two things. It depends on the nature of the difficulties and your background, and also depends on the therapeutic goals. So, for example, certain people, your goals is a lot more behavioral, right? I want to be able to do A, B, C, and they're pretty straightforward goals. They're pretty manageable, in which case, I don't know, maybe anywhere between 6 to 8 sessions should be adequate to, depending on how deep-rooted the issues are. If it's not too deep-rooted, it's still possible. But then, of course, there are a lot of individuals who are looking for bigger, higher level changes in terms of just their entire perspective that can go on for quite some time. So I'm sorry, I can't give you a very clear timeline. It depends on the individual and their goals. But when you work with a therapist, typically the first session you establish goals and we always check in on goals within like 4 sessions. We'll say, okay, where are we going? How close are we to this goal? So what we try to do is, you know, address these specific goals and we know when it's coming up and when we're getting there and when it's safe to terminate unless new things come up.
Okay.
All right. Can I add to that, Eliza, as a person remains in therapy?
Sure.
Like I said, I've been in therapy for more than 10 years. And I've gone through various therapists and therapy, and I found some therapists to be not suitable for me. Some who push medication on to me, and that was not suitable for me. Some who try to question me and use an analytical and logical way to set goals, and that didn't work for me, because sometimes when you go into therapy, you don't actually have goals and you don't even know what it is that you need to change.
Yeah.
It's through the discussions and the crying and the tears and the breakdowns and the living that will actually reveal to you what it is that your goals are, because my goals today are totally different from even 4 weeks ago or 4 years ago. So there is no time, because the more therapy I did, the more I realized what it is that I wanted to work on. And so I had to look for a therapist and find the form of therapy that wasn't so much goal oriented for me. It was more for somebody to sit with me, speak with me, provide a safe space where I could trust to vent, speak, and allow my inner self, my, as you would say, your inner child, because we all are children in adults' bodies, you know, to be able to feel safe and speak. And therefore, I could then grow, because my inner child and all of our inner childs have experienced certain patterns and certain traumas in our lives that kind of got us stuck in those periods of time. And the way we cope with present problems is the way that 12-year-old would have still coped. So this is just from me personally. So I had a lot of younger me's trying to catch up with 43-year-old me and realize, hey, you're okay, you're safe now, so you can grow into yourself. And that's still ongoing. If it was a goal to say, like, I've got this speaking thing coming up in like 3 weeks' time, I don't want to have a panic attack, for example. Like, I don't have that now, panic and anxiety. But there was no goal set for me. It just, the panic attacks and anxiety disappeared the more I released through therapy my feelings and discovered who I was. And that's something about Nyasa that I love, because it's not all just medical or, you know, cognitive. We do a lot of talk therapy, there's a circle support group, there's a lot of peer support, and there's even spiritual support. So it's holistic. And we have a clubhouse where you can come and talk in a safe space and, you know, get a lot off your chest. Because a lot of time people just want somewhere safe.
Yeah. Now, so you've mentioned Nyasa a couple of times now. And Nyasa is, hold on, let me see, is the Mental Illness Awareness and Support Association.
That's right. Right. Yeah.
Are the appointed patron of me.
Yes, that's right. Just this year.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it was just this year. So that's
it's just recent. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So tell us more about Nyasa and how you came to be involved with them.
Okay. So a couple of years ago, when Nyasa was formed, I started working with them more as a celebrity, like spokesperson. So when they wanted to talk about mental health, because I had been studying it and I'd been in therapy, I shared my experience. This is before I got pregnant. And then getting pregnant, I suffered from severe postnatal depression. I didn't know it was postnatal depression. When it hit me, it was 3 months after I gave birth, shaking. I found myself lying on the ground in my room, sweating, my heart pumping. I thought I was having a heart attack and I couldn't swallow. I felt like I was choking. And then I felt like my life was going to end and I didn't understand why. So I didn't go like, this is postnatal depression. It was more like, I think I'm going to die. What's happening? Why do I feel like I've swallowed like some sort of like, why have I got so much adrenaline that's pumping through my veins in fear? And then I was battling, like Lavender said, with this like, but you have nothing to worry about. You have a healthy child. Everything's good. You shouldn't feel bad. And then because I have a background in psychology and I studied therapy, I said, I got to call my therapist. Maybe this is postnatal, or maybe I'm finally losing my mind, you know? And I called her and she spoke to me for 2 hours on the phone to calm my brain down. And then I went in for subsequent intense trauma therapy and I had some assistance medically for 6 months. Now, let me tell you something. I rejected that medication big time. Nyasa also helped me. I contacted them and they gave me a lot of support. And to cut a very long story short, it's not that long, 6 months. I healed, thank God, the panic attacks went away, the anxiety went away, but through almost 4 times a week in therapy for a couple of months, yeah, to get what needed to be done, if you get what I mean. So you had to, I had to let go of all control. I was like, I'll never take medicine. I'm strong. I don't need medication. I'm me, you know, I will get over this. And then I would have this thought like, you're going to die. Maybe you'll jump out of the window. You know you shouldn't jump out of the window. But what if you do? Oh my God, you're going to die and go to hell. And all these thoughts, right? And I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. So I was like, okay, I'll give the meds a little bit of a chance. Took them, brain balanced out, trauma therapy at the same time. And everything just came back into high, like I would say high definition. You know, when you go to the cinema and everything goes zoom. I was like, oh my God. I woke up one day and I was like, what's going on? Where am I? Where did the last 6 months go? It was really strange. And I just kind of came to, you would say. So it kind of, not say snap, but it was like a gradual and snapped out of it, but true of health. MIASA is a non-governmental organization, and they helped me a lot in terms of feeling safe and also sharing my experience. So as I was going through the postnatal, I actually did a few talks with them. No one could see, but I was shaking underneath. And that helped me get courage and come out of the depression as well, seeing that I could achieve and do things while I was going through it. So we're trying to fight the misconception that people with mental health conditions or mental health illnesses can't survive or can't exist in society as functional individuals, which they can. There are so many services provided, from spiritual therapy to art therapy, dance therapy is coming up. It sounds a little bit like woo-woo, but trust me, if you visit MIASA and you go there, there are people every day phoning in. There's a hotline for crisis. The crisis team works 7 days a week. And there is a question about costs here. It is free for below 40, B40 group, free services. So you just need to contact MIASA, and the crisis team is there also every day, 7 days a week. And there is circle time every 2 weeks, peer support. Just give us a contact. There's so much to share about MIASA here, but the main objective is to spread awareness and decrease the stereotypes and the prejudices and be there for people in moments of crisis so that we can then, you know, decide where they need to go for further help after assessment, because there is an in-house therapist as well.
Okay, well, if anybody watching would like to learn more about MIASA, you can visit their website. It's miasa.org.my. So that's miasa.org.my.
Yes, thank you.
I think, yeah, we've put the website and all the other links and resources in the Zoom chat. We will also be sharing it on Facebook as well. So, you know, if anybody wants to just go click on it and go through and just read through what it is that MIASA and all these other organizations like The Mind offers, you can go ahead and do that. I would also like to ask you, Sarima. We live in a country where, you know, speaking about mental health is still taboo or spoken about in hushed tones, you know?
Yes, it is.
And for somebody like you, who's a celebrity, who's really just out there in, you know, in the forefront, you know, everybody knows who you are and what you're about and just how you are as a person, or rather they think you know they know how you are.
That's right. That's very good.
And for you to like come out and speak about these things, I, you know, some people may be really surprised to hear this. So I think this is a thing to just, so how do you think we can change this whole mental health is a taboo thing, and how do we do it quickly?
Well, we're doing it right now as we speak. And I believe, like all of us ladies and men or whoever's joined us here today, you know, this is part of it, isn't it? It's like every drop in the ocean counts pretty much. And it's not just here. I mean, it's talking, it's about like, it's really about ourselves. You know what I mean? How do we perceive mental health? Do we judge ourselves? You know, do we actually like talk here, but later, like somebody says, oh, that person has schizophrenia. Do we go, oh my God, is she or he gonna, you know, there's that prejudice, that stigma that's attached. How do we behave as individuals at the end of the day? There's fear, you know? And yes, our society, and I'm half Malay, and I'm mostly in the Malay entertainment. So when I start sharing stuff, you know, all the people, my target, you know, followers and stuff who have followed me over the years, they're shocked and they almost don't believe it. And there's always a reference towards supernatural or superstitious sort of beliefs that pop up, you know what I mean? In every culture, you know, like you need to pray more, you know, pergilah sembahyang, tak cukup doa ni, kalau percaya kena tawakal, kalau tawakal tu cukup je. And I'm like, dude, like, girls, guys, you know, we tawakal, but at the end of the day, we put faith in God, but we also kena berusaha. I mean, you got to have effort as well as faith. You don't just lie back if your leg's falling off and go like, heal me, God. You know, you got to get yourself to the hospital and get yourself healed. So there is usuhu at the same time as doa. So the main problem that I'm facing is trying to help people to understand that it is not a weakness because they fear it. And the media portrayal of people with mental health conditions or mental health illnesses need to change the reporting that has been done. If you look at a lot of the reporting, there are obviously ethics and guidelines and how to report instances of suicide, etc., that are not followed through, unfortunately. So MIASA is constantly campaigning for this, trying to change policies, trying to have inclusion for people with disabilities, because people with disabilities not only have disabilities, they also have mental health issues, and they're experiencing an awful amount of prejudice and problems in that aspect. And employment, you know, companies rejecting people because they're on medication. There's so many things, Eliza, that need to be changed. And the first step is, you know, what we see in the media and the movies and TV series. I mean, every Raya, I turn on the TV, and I'm sure some of you watching will understand. And I'm like, there's another woman that's being called like Gila, who's trying to kill her family. And, you know, it's because she didn't pray enough or something, you know, and we just need more education. And I would love to see the government start from young. I would love a campaign to be carried out, you know, nationwide, where we just have really simple messages to young children about what it means to feel afraid, nervous, to not be afraid of feelings. Because we're very much, I don't know, Lavender probably explained this to you, we're not very much a feeling society, we're more of a thinking society. And that's a little bit dangerous, because everybody thinks they know it all, and the feelings are actually repressed, you know, the true feelings. So I would like to see more people speak out about it. And then on that, talking about speaking out, there are some celebrities who've come out and spoken up recently, but they too need some guidelines, because oversharing as well is dangerous too for everyone. You don't want to be telling people what medication you're taking and too many personal details. Share, but, you know, have the boundaries there too, you know, to protect yourself.
Okay. Now, regarding the price of therapy in Malaysia, personally, therapy is something that you know, I go through. Like, I go for therapy with a counselor and stuff like that. And I consider myself quite blessed to be able to afford therapy, because let's face it, it's not particularly cheap, you know, especially here in Malaysia, and it's not covered by insurance either. So deters Malaysians from getting the help that they need. So Lavender, what do you think it would take for the rates for price for therapy to go down, to make mental health therapy and counseling more affordable to Malaysians?
That's a very good question, actually, and you're right. It is a huge barrier for a lot of people. The reason that therapy is expensive is because, you know, training, continuous learning, psychological tools, all these things are expensive. And just because the field is relatively new in Malaysia, resources are not abundant yet. But actually, I feel quite optimistic about it. I do see a lot of progress in terms of government sectors, a lot of hospitals are hiring more professionals as much as they can. So there is some growth there. A lot of NGOs are doing great work, like MIASA, MMHA, Souls Health. So these organizations make therapy more accessible to a lot of people in different levels of financial abilities. And even for us in private sectors, we work a lot with corporates, huge corporations, to provide therapy as employee assistance programs. So regardless of your level, even if you're a fresh grad, you know, at an executive level, and you're still struggling to kind of find your footing, at least this is an allocation that's available to you. And this actually opens up a lot of access to people. It's just that maybe sometimes people are not aware of what's available to them. So I do think that awareness is key. The more that the field grows, the more that acceptance and awareness grows, it increases accessibility for everybody. So as individuals, maybe what we can do is just try to share more resources. So a lot of mental health professionals are trying to put valid information out there so that people can learn about it, can talk about it, what it actually means to have this disorder or that disorder, or what these symptoms mean. So actually talking to your friends about it, having these kind of discussions, that's very important. Or if you feel like you have some relatively manageable difficulties, but you want to improve yourself, or maybe, you know, like Sarima said, you're looking at self-growth. If you're open to it, you can even seek therapy with a trainee So that way you're contributing to the growth of the number of professionals.
Right. But Liza, can I just add that Miasa services are free for B40s, and also for those who need food, drinks, and hygiene products, you can register at Miasa. So that's what we're doing to help on our part. It's a collaboration with the Lost Food Project, and sometimes we work with One Moment for them, and they offer free therapy to B40s as well. So like one peer gets like 5 free sessions, etc. And I just wanted to add to price. Okay, let's just look at this like. This is what I say to my friends who, you know, say, but it's so expensive, like 300-400 ringgit, how am I supposed to? And I'm like, just hold on a second, just cuba fikir sekejap, ya. Like, if you lose your job, God forbid, or you get in a car crash, or you lose your health as you're coping with stress and anxiety in a way like overworking, over-exercising, or you just basically lose your mind and can't function, how much will that cost you? So if you put it into a bigger perspective of life, the investment, people don't think about, it's no problem to invest in a house and whatnot, but what's the point in having a house if you can't appreciate it and you can't even think straight? You know, so the cost therapy, if you look at it just as a whole, the benefits and how it comes back to you, because you're investing in your mind, which affects your entire being. So that, I don't think, you know, I mean, if you look at it in the bigger scale of things, it is just an investment back into you and your family.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah.
There's a question there, Eliza, about something that happened recently with
Yeah, we'll get to questions in a bit. We're about to open Q&A really soon.
Great.
But just, you know, there was this article that I read on the New York Times, which I think we will share the link to the article in the chat as well and on Facebook. And the name of the article, there's a name for the blah you're feeling. It's called languishing. So for people who, you know, have not really, they're not entirely depressed, but they're not happy either. You know, they're not pre-COVID happy. So there's like this lull that we're all, I think, kind of in. So Lavender, how can we manage languishing?
I love that article. So many of my clients have brought it up because it's so great to have the language to just describe how we're feeling. Question, yeah. I think begin with the first step with languishing is getting to a certain level of acceptance for our emotions. Like you guys talked about just now, right? We are a thinking society. We're not okay with having these emotions. A lot of my clients will say, you know, at least I kind of, like I have a job or I have a roof over my head. There are much less privileged people, so I shouldn't be feeling this way. I should be more productive. I should be using this time to work on this project and that project. So there's so much self-criticism just for experiencing languishing. And I actually feel like that is a big portion of why we're feeling that way. So to begin with, accepting that, yes, of course, there are people who are suffering more than me, but it is okay for me to also be mourning the loss of my regular life. I'm mourning the loss of being able to go out and spend time with my friends, right? Or for certain people with their families out of town, that is actually a significant loss to not be able to see your parents for a whole year. It's okay for you to be a little bit down about that. So I think that's the start to actually give yourself some self-compassion. So important and like such a struggle for everybody that I've met. That's step one. And step two is what I've been working on with a lot of my clients as well, is just to find small joys as much as we can. In our regular lives, we have so much to look forward to. We have our holidays, we have our promotions, big weddings, these kind of things. We don't really have that anymore, or we don't know when we can get it back. So just in your day-to-day life, you know, taking a walk around the neighborhood with your partner, patting the neighborhood cats. If you're too tired, too languishy to do a HIIT workout, it's okay. You know, maybe a nice yoga class with somebody like an instructor whose voice you find soothing. So that's one thing, finding little things, connecting with others, finding ways to give back, any little ways that you can give back to charity to make you feel connected, to feel like you are helping other people. That's a good way to, I wouldn't say combat languishing. I think just address it a little bit. Yeah. I don't think it's something you can do.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's all the questions that I have for you guys, but we do have questions from our readers that we're taking here on Zoom. So for future sessions, you know, to everybody who's watching, if you want to ask our speakers questions, our guests, sign up to the Zoom sessions for Hello Zofigo, and we will take your questions as we go. Now, for this session, Marina actually has a question for, I think this is for Lavender. Are there gender differences in access to therapy? Do women go to therapy more than men?
Okay, I think statistically there is a gender difference. They say women are more open to talking about their feelings and more open to seeking therapy. There is you know, toxic masculinity. There's this perception like, oh, you should just man up, not talk about it. But in practice, I actually see an equal number of clients. I am not sure if it's just because women are more open about telling everyone else that they go to therapy. Yeah. So I'm not sure about that.
The second question that we have is also from Marina. She says, the recent cases of sexual harassment in schools, obviously, the school counselors are failing the students, but these are obviously traumatic events for them. So how do you think therapy can help kids who, you know, go through these things that we've recently discovered?
That's a very good question. I am not so sure whether school counselors are failing them, because I'm not 100% sure all of these schools have school counselors.
Yeah.
Right. So that's one thing to think about. Maybe either the schools don't have school counselors, so they don't actually have access to school counselors in the first place. Or secondly, maybe the school counselors are overwhelmed. Maybe it's one counselor to like God knows how many students, right? Yeah. Or maybe the school counselor is inhibited by the school system, where if the principal does not allow you to support the student, what can you do, right? Mm. But in terms of how therapy can support them, the way that children interpret things, it makes them very vulnerable, because for children, right, they are quite egocentric, meaning that they are mostly able to see things from their perspective. So when horrible things happen to them, I'm sure you guys have heard of it, you know, like children of divorce, they do tend to blame themselves for their parents breaking up. They'll say, it's something I did, these kind of things. So with these kind of sexual harassment, it is very common for children to start blaming themselves. Was it something I did? Was it the way I dressed? Was it something I said? So therapy is very important in helping them see that, you know, this is not your fault, and it is the fault of the perpetrator that they went through this, and to have support and to have somebody listen to them and feel like their feelings and their thoughts and their feelings of anger and upset are valid, because they may not get that elsewhere.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Eliza, can I add to that? Because I actually posted something on my social media about what happened with the recent rape cases and the jokes that were made at the school, etc. And I experienced two full-on days of constant bombardment of messages from people in society, unfortunately men defending other men, saying that it is the fault of the woman, and a lot of victim blaming. And I think that is very much prevalent in our society. And that's possibly why it happened to begin with, because we live in a society, I can't blame patriarchal societies, because there are many patriarchal societies in the world where that would be unacceptable. I think it's boundary setting issues. We don't seem to have boundaries placed around what's acceptable when it comes to discussing sex or sexual issues in our culture. And I think that's because we shy away from discussing it. So all we know is what is bad, what is good, what is sin, what's allowed. And when that happens, there's like a blurry sort of like, nobody knows, like, is this okay or not okay? And then finger pointing. So if there's a joke made, it must be the teacher's fault only. And then he goes, well, women dress too sexy. And I had this whole debate on my social media page, and I realized that there were a lot of men who were answering with defensiveness, not because they actually believe that it's okay, but because they felt helpless. They were like, what can we do? So I feel like we need to empower men more to get support for their mental health issues, or just their mental health, so that they we can come out of this society where there's this whole like, hush, don't go see anyone, you're fine, you should be strong as a man, so that men can go somewhere productive and safe to deal with their, instead of turning to pornography or alcoholism or, you know, any other addiction, etc., to cope negative in a negative way. And I realized when I said to the men and my followers online, guys, you know, you're the protectors of us women, just to see what they would do, their whole perspective on it shifted. It was no longer about blaming the way women dressed. It became, oh, we are. Okay, then. That's not acceptable, that joke. If anyone said that to my daughter, I'd go and smack him. You know, and I was like, wow. So maybe they need to be empowered more, you know? So I always believe in empowering people rather than saying there's something wrong with you. You know, go take care of yourself. Get therapy, not because there's something wrong with you. Go get therapy because you deserve it for yourself, yeah. You know? And I'm so not a feminist, like, you know, men are wrong. I don't believe in that. I'm half Irish, half Malay, and I've grown up in both societies where there's, you know, different religions and different ways for men to be raised. And I still come down to men need as much help as women, and we're the same. We want to connect. And men have lost the ability to connect in societies like ours, and they need to learn how to reconnect with themselves. Yeah. So that they can have empathy and compassion for women.
That's actually a really good way of looking at it, because I think a lot of times, even when people, you know, respond to such social media posts, whether it's on Twitter, whether it's on Facebook, you do find a lot of times people are like, oh, but what was she wearing? What was she doing? You know, things like that. That sort of mentality, I think, really just needs to kind of be unlearned. You know,
yeah, it's just like drug addiction. You know, when if you look at the commercials in the cinemas or on our TV, you know, I cringe. I mean, they show this drug addict as this like disheveled person who's lost, you know, and I'm like, no, most drug addicts are educated people who have money, and you know, they're totally not like what's been depicted, you know. And the same with, unfortunately, rapists and an awful lot of cases right now with sexual abuse and rape. And everyone's kind of going, oh, my God, the person must be crazy. And I'm like, no, they're not crazy. They're just, this is formed over many, many years of conditioning and lack of boundaries and also unresolved trauma, et cetera. Not to justify the action at all, of course, but you can't just say the drugs are to blame or, you know, a person's lost their mind. We need to start looking as society into preventing rather than just seeing and reprimanding. Yeah. You know, this person raped someone, throw them in jail. In 5 years, they come out and they go rape again. What about rehabilitation and, you know, mental health itself? You know, Lavender, I mean, what do you think? I mean, I really feel like, you know, the system that we have at the moment is not serving us. It's kind of like creating a cycle and a loop of self-defeating helplessness.
Yeah, it's true, because there's so much victim blaming, right? There's so much focus on the people who are receiving this, and then it continues, like hurt people, right?
Yeah, it's definitely a cycle. We have a few more questions. There's one from Liana Khairuddin, who says, can you comment on the need to advocate mental health, especially to those who feel that they can't afford professional therapy? Most people will attempt to self-therapize through running or shopping. That itself can be an addiction. Yeah, I think we kind of addressed that in the questions earlier, Liana. I hope you know that Lavender's and Sarima's answers suffice. Moving to our next question from Vivian Lee. She says, I get asked to recommend good therapists all the time. Could you list some resources here? Actually, one psychiatrist, she says, because actually one psychiatrist for 200,000 people of the population is really sad. That figure doesn't include psychologists though, right?
No, it doesn't. I believe there are fewer psychologists, in fact, than psychiatrists.
Right, okay. Let's see, moving on to the next question from Hanani Damiri. Who says, sometimes we do tend to be self-critical and judgmental towards ourselves. How can we incorporate self-compassion more in our daily lives? Oh, that's a really good question.
That's a good question. This is a tough one, right?
Yeah.
Well, to begin with, I think we are often self-critical and judgmental partly because we grew up with that kind of messages being thrown at us. Maybe we hear that a lot. That's one thing, right? So you want to start noticing, where is this voice coming from? Who has told me this when I was growing up? Is it fair? Are these comments fair? That's one thing. Another thing is that people think that being self-critical and judgmental actually makes them better. That's what people say. I have to push myself, otherwise I'll just be lazy. I won't get anywhere. That's not really true. I like to use the analogy of a marathon, right? So let's say you sign up for a marathon. You have to run, I don't know, it's like 32 km or something crazy like that, right?
42 km.
Yeah, so like say you're running the whole km, and the whole time you're telling yourself, oh, you're so fat, you're so lazy, what is wrong with you, everyone's beating you, you're so useless, faster. How would you feel while you're running the marathon?
Well, demotivated, obviously.
Yeah.
Right? And then even when you get to the end, I don't think you've experienced much joy. At best, you feel relieved.
The mental exhaustion in addition to the physical pain that you're feeling.
Yeah, and then there's the whole, like, you only want to do it to prove to others that you could have done it. So it's not coming from, like, an internal sense of joy. I mean, I was growing up, I was bullied in Ireland for being Asian. I was bullied here and called Wadak Chiluk because I was, I wouldn't say fat. I was a cute child, okay, who liked to eat nasi, and I still do. And I was bullied relentlessly, and I was called like koto because my mom is Matsali, so therefore I'm koto and all these things. And I experienced so many prejudice, racist issues being half, you know. And I totally had a shattered self perception, I must say, and I still battle with it today. Eating disorders, body dysmorphic problems. I can't see good. I can only see the negatives. I can't see, I struggle with it. And I'm improving the more I look back and solve, you know, not say solve, the more I look back and have compassion for the younger self. Because back then I just developed defense mechanism and walls to deal with those attacks. And then I started attacking other people. You don't even realize, but you start becoming cutting yourself or a bit critical, you know what I mean? And then it becomes your personality, but actually it's evolved over time. And I self-compassion to me is not necessarily going somewhere on a hill and meditating, or, you know, I'm going to go to the spa for 3 hours. I think self-compassion is like allowing yourself to make mistakes and be a human being. So like if you shouted accidentally one day a little bit, in your opinion, at your child, you know, you have the right to say, look, I made a mistake. I could have done that better. Let me go speak to my child and say, mommy's not perfect. Or I'm your wife or I'm your husband. I'm not perfect. I have thoughts and ways of behaving that's not, you know, I mean, I'd like to improve on it. And that's self-compassion to yourself, not being like, oh my God, you failed. You know, why didn't you do it better? But that comes down to the whole thing we said in the opening of this talk, which is we are an achievement-driven society rather than a connecting and, you know, feeling society. And that's where the problem is, you know, I feel.
Yeah. Marina has a comment on what was said earlier about empowering men. She says, unfortunately, when men view themselves as protectors of women, it often expresses itself as curbing women's freedoms in the cause of like protection. I think there needs to be respect for women, that we have agency and we need to be empowered, which
we definitely do. But you know, in order for somebody to, we need to have power in ourselves. We don't take power from another person. So you don't allow someone to take power from you. But another thing is, why does somebody feel the need to put somebody down, even if it's under the guise of protection? Usually it's because they themselves feel small or down themselves, because it's very rarely if you're feeling empowered yourself that you want to put someone else down. Do you know what I mean? It's if you're feeling angry and bitter and like a lack of something in yourself that you need to actually put someone else down so that you feel higher than them. It's also a cultural thing, a culturally ingrained belief that, you know, protection perhaps equals repression. But that is culturally appropriate to a certain extent. And again, like I've seen it in Ireland and I've seen it in Malaysia. So it's not about like Asian or it's just done in different ways. You know, it's it's very subtle in some countries and it's very obvious where we are perhaps. But I mean more like when I say asking men to protect women, I mean empowering men to see that they don't need to repress women, that we can be equal, that you don't have, we're not up here and men are here and therefore you've got to go up here. You know, it's just, let's just be, you know, together here on this even keel. But that takes an awful lot of, we got to start with school, you know, we got to undo from now, today. Like, I'm worried for Sophia when she goes to school. I have to decide which school to send her to because I want her to learn about Malaysia and speak Malay, speak Bahasa. But I want her also to learn that she has value and worth as a girl and as a woman to be. So there's like a, it's a very difficult line, you know, where we are here in Malaysia. But, you know, we keep the dialogue going. I always say, don't defend back, because if you fight back, no one can hear you. You know, it's how you speak to people to get the message in. So if men are saying something that's, you know, against women's freedom or equality, there's no point in shouting back, I believe. You can just speak so that it goes in, because no one can hear when their brain's shut down because they've gone into defensiveness.
Yeah, okay. We will be extending the session for about, I think, you know, another 10 to 15 minutes. Because, you know, Zafigo is all about empowering women and encouraging women to explore and learn and improve themselves through travel. How do you think, you know, travel, especially solo travel, impacts one's mental health and whether or not it helps, you know, improve? I know it doesn't fix, but how, you know, what are the pros to helping?
I mean, the pros of like traveling or coping, like using travel. Well, you know, travel, I can only say personally for me, when I went through my difficult times in my life, I would do 13 episodes of a show and then hop on a plane and I would travel by myself independently. And I would join groups of people, and I've been to Italy twice and Japan twice. And that was my way of learning more about myself independently, seeing the world. Thank God I had the means, alhamdulillah, to be able to, not everybody can afford it, I understand. And I was fortunate. I saved from my jobs and I saw the world and I met other people, and what it gave me was different perspectives. So I believe that the pros of traveling for me as a woman, especially in terms of emotional distress, was being able to step back and have a different perspective and say, hey, the world's much bigger. Look at those cherry blossoms on that tree. And look at that old person standing there with their grandchildren. You mean, hang on, it's not all about me? You mean the world's much bigger, with much more culture, much more food and things to be experienced than just tears and sadness. And that's what travel did to me. And I absolutely cherish those weeks that I had to just walk around cities by myself with my little bag and just be alone and talk to the local people and literally smell the coffee and the flowers without, you know, anyone else. And I felt strong. I felt empowered. However, the cons that I have observed, and I could blame myself a little bit, you know, not blame, but I've seen myself leaning towards it, is running away and using travel to escape problems. So I think it's okay if you're like, say, going to therapy or you're addressing the issues where you are and then going away for a perspective or to learn something new, but not to expect where you go to change your life for you or to heal you. And some people do use that. I do know people who can't stay put. They're like, next flight, next flight, next flight. And I say, why? And they're like, because I can't stay here. I can't cope with what's going on.
Yeah.
So maybe that's a con, just that.
Okay. Lavender, how about you?
Okay. Well, I feel it, like Sarima says, as long as it's not being used as a distraction, it can actually be a very powerful act of self-love, especially as women. You know, our lives is always like, oh, serving other people, helping your kids or your partner, and at work we're expected to perform as well. So a lot of women that I know, they don't actually carve out time for solo travel. It's like family holidays where they are basically working because they have to pack the bags for the kids, you know, make sure the kids are fed, make sure everybody's taken care of. So when they travel in that way, it's not really relaxing for them as well. So like what you describe of solo travel or traveling with your girlfriends, it can really be an act of self-love to say, I deserve this. I deserve spending money and time on this. It doesn't matter how far you go, as long as it's time that you take for yourself to take care of yourself.
Okay. There are no more questions from the audience. So I will ask you, the question that we ask all our guests here on Hello Zapigo. And that is, if you could give our participants one advice you've learned through your experiences in life, what would it be?
You want to go first?
You go first, Levin. Go on.
All right. I think for me, I would say stress management is energy management. It took me some time to learn about this, you know, juggling like working with kids while in training at my practicum and taking care of family members who are unwell. All of these things was so exhausting. And then I realized actually, if we manage our stress, our mental health is our resource, our energy, our sleep, our state of mind. That is what we are working with. So a lot of people will tell me, I'm too busy. I can't rest. I'm too busy. I can't go for therapy. I'm too busy. I can't take a break. Well, yeah, but if you don't do these things, you might be working for 12 hours, but you're much less productive. You might be physically there for your partner or your friends or your family, but emotionally, you don't have the capacity to connect, to really help them. So at the end of the day, it really starts from within. If you don't have your resources in check, you're not really helping anybody.
Right. No, that is, I think, basically the quote of the month. Stress management is energy management. That is gold. That's absolute gold. I think that's something that everybody needs to kind of look into for sure. Sorry, Ma, what about you?
I mean, that's great, Lavender. I just feel so compassionate for a lot of the moms I know. They just, their energy is so depleted, do you know what I mean? And they perhaps don't have a spouse or a support system that will even allow them to manage that time for themselves. So I would say, to add to yours, if you can do stress management, you know, that is the way to go, of course. But if you find yourself in a situation in your life where everything's kind of gotten on top of you, there is no time for you to even manage, just sort of like take a deep breath within yourself and ask you, the real you, are you being you? And this helped me. It really helped me after my postnatal depression to ask myself if I was being truthful to me in terms of how I was living. Have I taken on, and am I just agreeing to be a people pleaser? Am I staying in this job because I want to achieve and look amazing and have more followers? Am I exercising only because I'm scared I'll gain weight? And what does that mean to me? People will say that I'm not good looking. Am I saying I'm in love because I'm scared to lose the person and become financially independent myself? Like, ask those really hard questions to you so that you can really live the life for you. Do you know what I mean? Because I realized I was living a life for very many versions of an ideal me for many years, until I started realizing that the true me was somewhere squashed underneath. So, but I had to stop and go like, I don't really want to do this job. I don't even really like this person that I'm hanging out with. Like, why am I doing this? You know, I'm sure you guys know what I'm talking about here. You know, when you have those moments where you're like, why did I even agree to come to this event? Like, I hate being here right now, you know? And I only came because I want to impress so-and-so. Like, really ask yourself, like, are you living for you or are you just living for others? And then, you know, from there, work it so that you stop adding more and more to you that you can't cope with, so that you can manage your time, manage your stress. You will find more time for you because you know who you really are then, instead of who you think you are.
Okay, that's a lot of gems dropped by the book. Yeah, I think that brings us to the end of our session. I would like to thank both of you, Lavender and Sarima, for giving me your time, for giving all of us, you know, here watching on Zoom and on Facebook, your time, your Saturday afternoon. Thank you also all our guests, everybody in the audience for joining us. A huge thank you for to Ari for, again, sponsoring the tops that Lavender and I have on. Mine is in blush pink. Lavender's is in...
I want one. Can I have the blush pink, please? How do I get it?
I think Ari, we will be really happy to send you one. That's for sure. The yes. We are Ari. That's we, W-E-R-A-R-E. Ari, A-U-R-I.com.
Okay.
The Marina three-quarter sleeve dolman top that is inspired by our Zabigo founder, Marina Mahathir. Once everybody, I think that would be a good time for everybody to turn on your cameras so that we can just do a little group shot really quickly. So,
we can see everyone now.
Everybody show your beautiful faces. Cameras on. Don't worry about how you look. Everybody's beautiful and relaxed. The best version of yourselves on a Saturday.
Yeah.
Aw. Everybody looks
good. Aw.
Hi. LN Farah Faruzari, I'm sorry. Mei Tan and Kieran Bra. We can have your cameras on really quickly.
If it was me, I'd be like running to the toilet now. Like, what do I look like?
Everybody's like, oh no. Just putting on the makeup. Last call. Oh no.
Last call at the ladies.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Okay. Privacy. Aww. Oh no. Okay.
That's so cool. I'm going to take a photo too.
Yeah, please do that. May, Kieran? Yes, no? Last call? Okay, that's fine. I think we'll just go ahead and do the group shot. Everybody's smiley face. Oh, Wangho, there's no camera either. Okay, that's fine.
Okay.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Sin. Thank you, everybody, for spending your Saturday afternoon with us on Hello Zabigo.
Thank you.
Check into zabigo.com to find out when our next session will be. There will be one session held every month for the rest of the year, all the way up till November. I hope everybody has a good weekend, and we will see you again soon. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Okay. Bye.